Patrick, how are you?
I am so good, and I'm so good because Easter is coming up. Because I've been, as an Irish Catholic, I've been doing Lent, which is fasting, which means I'm feeling good, I'm looking good, I've lost weight, I'm slim, I've been off chocolate, I've been off crisps and tea, so I'm good.
Have you been fasting, like all in fasting, or is it just the just naughty
As
stuff?
well, so I've been doing. I've taken out my bad habits. The only bad habits I have is that I drink too much tea. I don't drink or smoke or gamble or do any, I don't have any vices, but I definitely drink way too much tea, and I eat way too much chocolate. So I've went off tea, chocolate, and crisps, and then I've done some intermittent fasting as well, which is where I do all my food within 8 hours, and then I don't eat for 16. It's so easy. It's just normal. It's good.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think I've ever done that in my entire life.
Y'all, we need to hang out more.
I know, you need some of your good habits need to be rubbed off onto me, honestly. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to come and speak to Kat and I. Do you know that you're the first man to be on this
It's usually the case. Honestly, I get invited to talk at so many women's events, the Professional Women's Network, things like that, and I really feel such an honor to be the guy that gets to represent almost the guys in a female dominated environment. I feel very comfortable in that environment, and I try to tell the truth and just.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think you feel comfortable in those
I
environments?
think I know why it is. I'm actually qu I'm quite balanced. I've got quite a lot of feminine energy, but also quite a strong masculine energy. So I've always been able to connect very well with women since I was a baby. And I grew up in Ireland in a village surrounded by women, my cousins, aunts, neighbors. So I'm a boy that's a product of women who loved me from a very young age. And as a result of that, I love women, and I want to see women succeed, which is why I wrote my book, Forgive Me, Sister. We can come back to that.
Yep,
But
we're de that's
at the same
definitely.
time, I'm very much a masculine man as well. But I feel as if I have a foot in both camps, and I feel that's where my strength is actually as a human being, that I am non-threatening to women and to men.
Interesting. Now, speaking of, you mentioned your book, Forgive Me, Sister. But I want to start off with your, we always ask our guests to tell us a little bit about your origin story and arriving in Sweden. So how did that all come about? What's the background there?
Yeah, so my origin story began when I was 16. I grew up in the unemployment black spot of Europe in Northern Ireland, where there was a lot of bombings and shootings and trouble. There was 3,000 people in my community died, at the hands of terrorists and everything around that. But when I was 16, I decided that I wanted more than that. I wanted to aim higher. And therefore, I designed my dream life at 16 years old. And I did a very simple thing, where I asked myself two questions. And the first question was, what are my dreams? Like, what could, if I could have anything, what would it be? So I said, if there was three things in the world, no matter how crazy it sounds, that I could have, what would they be? And for me, it was quite obvious at 16 years old, the most important thing I wanted was to have season tickets at Old Trafford, watching Manchester United. That's the mind of a 16 year
Simple
old, you
dreams,
know?
simple dreams.
And the second thing was to have a Porsche before I was 30. And the third thing was to travel the world. Now, bear in mind, I had literally never seen a Porsche in my life. Like, where I lived, there was more car bombs than sports cars, and the cars that were on fire were not Porsches. So.
No. How did you, what, speaking about that, going back to when you were 16 and you were in this particular situation in Northern Ireland in the midst of the Troubles, how does a 16-year-old boy suddenly go, because in this, because you're surrounded by this situation and surrounded by people who are in this situation, what was the catalyst that made you go, I want more than this? Obviously, to get out of it, but there must have been one moment or something that made you go, how do I get out of
I
this?
really appreciate that you asked me that, because I always run past this to speed the story up for people. So it was actually a Friday night, and in our town they have this event once a year called the Flyer-Svensktrabban, which is where the local guilds basically talk. They do a jig. It's almost like a local version of a beauty contest, but very Irish and very country,
Okay,
where they wear their best dress, that type of thing. And actually, we were at that, and my sister was one of the girls on stage that year, and I went in with my father and my sister, and I was looking around, and I was actually sort of hanging on the back of my seat like this as a 16-year-old looking around me, and I realized this is good. This is as good as it gets for us. Like this one night a year, everyone was happy. I was looking in like a slow motion, sort of detached approach, realizing this is the best it is, and everyone's dressed up, they're smiling, they're laughing, they're drinking, they're having fun. And I thought, this is not enough for me. And actually, that was that moment, and I remember as vividly today as I did then. That moment was the catalyst for me going, I want more. It was actually over the next couple of days and weeks that I started saying, like, what does more mean? Because more is a very vague term. How can I define more? And that's why I asked myself the first question. If I could have three things in the world, no matter what it is, what would they be? And then the second question I asked myself was, what do I need to achieve to get these three things? And my problem as a 16-year-old boy is that I wasn't good at anything. And no one ever encouraged me, or no one ever says he will be good at this. No one ever picked me out and goes, he's got potential in that. Never, not once. And so I thought about it again, and I thought, what can I do at school? And the thing that I was always okay at school was mathematics. And I thought, right, the best I can do with that is become an accountant. And accountants deal with money, so they must be rich. So that sounds like a logical approach. So I made a three-step process for me, and the three steps was, I'm 16, I want to come top of the class by the time I'm 18. I'm going to start, doing my homework and stuff like that. I want to get engaged. I think this is my easiest path out. Then I wanted to, excuse me, I wanted to become the first person from my area to go to university because no one had ever been before. And the third thing is that I wanted then, once I got a degree, I wanted to go to university. I wanted to move to Dublin or Belfast to become an accountant at one of these firms. And of course, I couldn't ask anyone for advice because there was no accountants where I lived. I mean, it was the unemployment black spot of Europe, never mind jobs. There was nobody even, if you get into a factory, you were okay. And that's what I did. So I was 16. So to sort of bring you forward in the story, go forward 10 years to when I'm 26. So let me just give you one more insight so we can understand the struggle I had. I went to school after the summer holidays, and the teacher was like, so does anyone know what they want to be after leaving school? Because we'd just done our GCSEs and we were going into the next level, A levels and GNVQs and stuff. And I was the only one put up my hand, and she goes, what are you going to be? And I says, I'm going to be an accountant, and she goes, no. You can't do that. But don't forget, the thing is, I didn't respect them. I didn't respect their opinion when they put up or down. It was just neutral to me. These people had never given me a chance anyway, so it didn't matter that they told me I couldn't do it. I was like, well, I had decided this in May, whenever I was at this employer switched your van. Your opinion, like, your opinion is not
Doesn't mean anything,
valuable at
man.
this stage, like September. And
Do you think that even maybe her opinion made you more determined to do it?
literally, it was like water off a duck's back. That's what I'm saying. Like, it didn't matter to me at all. But actually, about a week later, there was this cool teacher, and he seen me in the corridor, and he came over and he walked me up the corridor. He actually had his hand around my shoulder, and he said, Patrick, I heard you wanted to become an accountant. They must have been in the staff room laughing at me.
Shocked, probably.
Someone has got ambition. Here, we need to cut that out. But, so he actually came over, put his arm around me, and he walked up the corridor and goes, here, Patrick, I need to tell you. My smartest ever friend, he wanted to be an accountant, and he couldn't do it. And I remember thinking to myself, you're clowning. Like, you don't know anything about he could have been on the drink. He could have been part, he might not have studied. I mean, it's not about being smart, it's about persistence and dedication and all those things. And I already knew this even at first week in school as a 16-year-old boy. And I was thinking, wow, these people are really silly people. Like, but again, it was water off a duck's back. I didn't
I
tell me I was the
am
best or the worst, it didn't matter.
I'm astounded that a 16-year-old boy at that particular time in Northern Ireland was that kind of had that much self like resilience. It was about resilience. I mean, that's a huge amount of resilience to keep going. I am so determined. I'm so. I mean, it's. Just, I've never like. Do you never kind of sit there and wonder How did I get like that? How did I, you know, what fostered that kind of level of, you know, even I didn't have that sort of resilience when I was 16. Like, yeah. It's amazing.
Well, I have to be honest with you, I think I was already so beaten down.
Okay.
You know, I think I was just, everything that could be said about me or every member of my family was already said at the time I was six. So it was just, I mean, it's such a tough upbringing anyway, to be in that environment. And don't forget, like, people calling you names and bad words is the least of your word. Like, I've seen so much bombs. I've seen so many people. I've seen dead bodies outside of my front door, you know, that type of way. So, and I don't feel, there's another element to this too. And I realized it is that the biggest problem in my society wasn't the bombings and the shootings. It was this victim mentality. Which we had in our society. And where I lived, the people blamed the British, they blamed the Protestants, they blamed the rain, they blamed the dog. It was never their fault that their life was crappy. And I, it was actually around that time that I was realizing this, like, and I actually made a decision at that time. I says, I will never be a victim of anything. I says, no matter what goes wrong in my life, I will take full responsibility. So if I don't get the grades I want, it's not on the teacher. They don't care about me anyway, that's obvious, but I have to make it so good that they can't mark me down. If I don't get the interview, it's on me. It's not on the, he didn't care that I'm a Catholic from Ireland. He wants the best person on his team. So I have to make myself that best person. And you know, from working with me as like in a client sort of relationship between each other, Jill, I'm all about, when I meet you across the table, my whole thing is, what can I do to serve this person? Like, how can I make their life easier and better? And if I can do that with you and with Kat and anyone else who comes across and have that intention of giving before the person comes in, I will ultimately win in the long term. I won't get everything, but in the long term, the I think life begets life. And the more life you give out, the more life it comes back to you.
Yep. So fast forward, you managed to become an accountant.
Go forward 10 years, right?
Yeah.
I'm 26 years old. Where do you hear the crack? Kat, where are you from?
From Southeast England.
So whereabouts?
Surrey.
Surrey. So what do you hear this next part, right?
Oh God.
This is how much of a farmer I was, right? I forward 10 years, and I've come top of the class in school. I've won awards throughout Northern Ireland. I was taken to Lloyd's of London to collect an award. Like, wow, Lloyd's of London, what? And then I went to university. I got 2 degrees, business studies and accounting, and I came second in the year in both. And then, and that's a big thing. Ask me about coming second later. And the third thing is I went to Grant Thornton. I became a chartered accountant, and I passed all my exams and all my mocks the whole way through. I was the only person to do that, actually. And I'm 26 years old, and every Friday I've qualified as an accountant. I've joined PricewaterhouseCoopers to become a tax lawyer. And every Friday I leave the office in my suit and tie. I get the bus to the airport. I fly to Manchester for the weekend, and I'd just be a lad. I'm over there getting hammered, singing the songs. And I was such a farmer, I thought English girls were the most exotic thing ever. So I actually loved going over to get these English girls. They were like this, like, superior race of the magical people of all races, colors, creeds. Because I had never met anybody who wasn't really an Irish Catholic before. You know what I mean? We should go to England and meet these cool, like, kids from India, heart origin, all the girls were black girls, white, like everything. You'd be like, wow, this is such an amazing multicultural society. And that's how much of a farmer I was. I really hear this. It gets worse, man. So that was every Friday night. I'm 26. I'm 27. I'm doing my tax law exams. I'm a QFA exams. And I'm working for PwC. And when I leave work on a Friday, I'm now jumping into my Porsche, driving to the airport, flying to Manchester, having a laugh. You know, I've been out for the weekend and just loving England and the multiculturalism of it and the sort of freedom that came with it. And then I was 28 in May 2007. I became a tax lawyer, a QFA, an accountant. I had 2 degrees. I was more qualified than I could deal with. So I sold everything I had as a backpacker. Sold my Porsche. I had another car. I had all the stuff I had. I got rid of it. And my goals was, number one, season tickets at Old Trafford, Porsche, and travel the world. So I got rid of the season tickets and the Porsche, and I set out around the world to backpack. And I just went. I just wanted to learn about the world. What I actually did is I stayed out for 7 years. I went to 140 countries across 7 continents. And how I traveled, I used to pick 2 points on the map and go from one to the other. So I went coast to coast on every landmass. And one of the journeys I did was brought me to Sweden, ironically, getting around to your question, 10 minutes later.
Yep.
I was in Rio de Janeiro and I heard there was a group of lads guys and girls who were going from London to Sydney and overland. Yeah. I thought I've never drove from London to Sydney, so that's an option. So we set off. I flew from Rio, stopped in at home in Ireland, and went to London and joined this bus of people who were going to Sydney. And we drove all the way to Australia from the UK. And 2 days after arriving in Sydney, I went into this backpackers bar and I seen these two blonde girls in the corner, and I think it was 5 to 7, and happy hour finished at 7. And beers were so expensive in Australia, and I was a backpacker, so I was skint as well. So I thought, wait, okay, beers first, then girls. So I remember walking over to these two girls, double fisting. I was like, what's the crack? And I got talking to one of them, and then I realized the other girl, and I just was like, that girl behind her is the woman of my dreams, and I'm married to her now, and she was from Västerås, just outside Stockholm, and that's why I'm in Sweden.
And the rest is history.
And then I met
so
girls.
So it took you to travel around the entire world to eventually find the woman that you would marry and move to Sweden.
Yeah,
that's a pretty epic origin story.
That's my origin story, and it's a bit long, but sorry.
No, it's great. But the thing I want to know though is, like, what made you just suddenly go, that's it, just throw everything, just sell everything, get rid of everything and go? What was it just that you just had enough of the lifestyle, or was it?
No, it was literally the 16-year-old boy. I promised it to him. And I realized when you have Porsches, and because the more money and the more higher up the chain you go, the more you're enslaved by the system that you become into, it's harder for these people to walk away from the big salary. And when you have a Porsche, it was so weird because I had a really great, really sporty Peugeot 306 D Turbo, and I loved it. And I had a Porsche. And when I would drive the Porsche through Dublin, people would let me out at the junctions, and it was like the world was awesome. And then I realized then I'm driving my Peugeot some nights, and then I would just be like, wrong car, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not like that at all. Like, I really don't understand that type of logic, but I can understand why people get trapped in it.
Yeah.
But again, the promise that I had made to my 16-year-old self about getting season tickets, a Porsche, and traveling the world, is my education. The fact that I'm blessed to speak to you, great girls, comes from the fact that I've been to your countries, to your town, you know, I've been around the world, and I can relate to people and be honest to them and get that comfort in myself.
Yeah. So tell us about you, but by that point as well, you'd started writing. So you were already becoming, going towards your goal of becoming a published author.
Yeah.
What was it that drove you to start writing these amazing stories? Was it for yourself, or was it, you know, did you want to spread your experiences to other people? What was that for?
You know, this is the best question again. We should need to hang out more big time. No one asked me these questions. I just lost them, and people think, did he really say he drew it? No, couldn't have done. No, it was actually one of those magical, mysterious English girls who gave me the idea. This mad race of women from the Amazon or something.
English unicorns.
But I was actually driving again from London to Sydney, and I was along with this girl from, I think she's from down around, sorry, actually, Annette. And she says, and Facebook and all had just come out, social media. She says, it'd be great if someone wrote a book about, you know, all the statuses and stuff like that. And, you know, because statuses not were big, Patrick is. So in Bali, I was lying on the beach, and I says, well, I'm someone, I could do it. And it was my first book, and it came out 6 months later. I sort of worked on it in between backpacking, and I wrote a lot of it in the library because I didn't have a laptop or anything with me. So I'd go into the library in the evenings in Sydney at the harbour, amazing building, and I would write and send it off, and people would look at it and stuff. And I got it published, and I decided even though I was a backpacker and I was broke, from the first moment I decided that every penny I ever got from all my books would go to mm-hmm. helping the homeless people. So
every book
every
that you've
penny,
written,
every cent,
wow.
Every cent has always went to the homeless. And even when I was broke, I thought the most important thing for me to do is to help those who have even less. And I don't know, I have no connection to homeless people. I don't know where it came from, but I've for 13 years now, I've maintained it. Every quarter, I get a royalty check. And now I have got like, I don't know, a whole lot of books. But mm-hmm. every quarter, I realize that I don't need another shirt, or maybe I do need a shave, and maybe things like that. But people need dry socks. People need underwear. You know, could you imagine being, I think about it as a man being out on the streets day after day with wet socks and dirty underwear. And then I think about women. How much of, what I do is I go to, in the UK, Primark, or I go to like Uluret or somewhere here, and I buy briefs, because men and women can wear briefs. And whoever I come across, I just give them what they need, just fresh stuff. And then hats, scarves, glue, you know, hoodies, those types of things. And the thing about the homeless is they're difficult people to deal with. I can say that for sure, because people, I'm not going to get romantic about it. There's a reason a lot of the people are on the streets, because they have had their troubles. But there's a real honesty in the homeless, in that they never take more than they need. So if you give them a pair of socks and go, here, take another pair for, you know, tomorrow, they're like, no, I've got socks and I'll worry about tomorrow when tomorrow comes. Yeah. So there's no such thing as hoarding or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's rewarding, but it's I feel as if I must give something back to the people who can never pay me back. You know, it's not about how can I help them to get something back. It's yours. Stay alive, please.
Yeah. And then once you'd written the books about the Facebook status, you then wrote the book about backpacking.
Yeah.
So the backpacker who sold his supercar.
Yeah.
And that was the story. That was the story about the 16-year-old, 16-year-old you. But tell me about Forgive Me, Sister.
Yeah.
Because that's something that I'm quite interested in. So what was it's a fictional note, it's a fictional book. And what was, how did that idea come, or where did it come from?
So basically I was in the Netherlands and I was at this yoga meditation sort of spiritual retreat, and I got this idea out of the blue again and it was the strangest one of them all, because I'm, if you think about my background, I was very much a left side of the brain person, which was analytical, numbers, boxes, that type. That's the sort of person an accountant generally is, and I never really fitted in as an accountant anyway, but I still could make it happen, you know. I was determined enough to do it. But this book came, and in the same moment I was given the story, the idea, the cover idea, the name idea, everything just came to me at the one go, and I never gave up on it. And that was in May, coming up now, so 3.5 years ago, 4 years ago. And the book was about, so Forgive Me, Sister was, to explain the title, was so sister is womanhood, the feminine, and forgive, and me is us as a planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about all humans. We have all been responsible for the suppression of the feminine energy, and for the destruction of it, and the sort of guilt that comes along with, you know. And I'm talking about a lot of gay men and stuff too, are very feminine. They have been beaten down. So the sister is the feminine that lives in our world, and womankind generally. It's very tough to be a woman. The more I grow up, the more I appreciate how just much effort these girls had to put in, more than me, to turn up even just on this podcast. Just so much more energy and consumption and thought process that has to go into everything.
And I don't think we realized as well, it's coming as a shock to us too.
I think it's coming to the fore as well now, recently, in the last sort of 2-3 weeks as well, with what's happened in London with Sarah Everard, and people talking a lot more about, you know, how it is, how daily life is for women, and the, you know, all the list of things that women have to think about walking home at night. And I saw one the other day, and it was a list of sort of 13, 14 things. And then they'd ask men, and it was like, I don't have to think about this.
I've got my phone. It's
just not an issue.
Yeah.
No, like, honestly, it's like, I was talking to one of the girls in Epicenter recently. She's from Serbia, living in Sweden. She goes, she said something that just triggered me, because I am the guy that she was talking about. She goes, I would love to be a man for one day just to think I am amazing. And I was like,
yeah.
I think I'm amazing.
That I'm with her. I would love to be that man for one day and just to be just show up and be like, I am great, my thoughts are great, everything that's going to come out of my mouth is amazing.
It resonated with me so deeply because I was thinking, wow, these girls are putting in so much effort and they still don't even feel awesome. Whereas I'm, look at me, man, I'm a mess. Good mess. It's a good mess. I'll work it out.
So Forgive Me, Sister was published. Yeah. And then you've really, well, from what I, how I feel about it, that's been your tenant, really. You know, you've kind of continued that the red thread through what you've done. Sure. Since you've come here, you know, since you come to Sweden.
I feel as if, and I wrote that book in 3 weeks. I just channeled the whole thing. It just came to me all the way through. Mm. And the start of the book is very, very violent and very squeezy. I mean, you have to just even look at it for free on Amazon or anything where you can read the first pages and see how nasty it is. That was an analogy for what we're doing to our earth, you know, the raping and pillaging of our earth. And that is the feminine again. We call it Mother Earth, and we treat our own mother that we live on and live off so bad and so destructively. And we're supposed to then respect our neighbors and our female mothers and sisters and girlfriends and all, but we can't even respect the earth that feeds us and nourishes us every day. So it really runs through my heart, like the empowerment of the feminine. Mm-hmm. Generally, mm-hmm. And that's mostly women, but also then you have, you know, gay men and different people like that as well. And the other thing that I just did in the past week, I think last week, you wouldn't believe what I got through last week.
What you do every week amazes me, Patrick.
I actually, based on there's twin sisters in the book. There's a twin brother and sister in a book called Kate and Richard, and I try to help people what I can. And I realize that a lot of kids now are really anxious, depressed, stressed. And I wanted to write a storybook about helping parents to help kids to meditate. And what I did is I took the characters from Forgive Me, Sister, and I put them into a children's book called Sister and Brother. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple book. And last week I released it in Swedish and I released it in English. And the Dutch version is hopefully coming out today if it's not already out. And there's the Finnish, Norwegian, Icelandic, German, French, and Danish book is all in the next coming days. The reason languages is the original English one is in English, but every other book it's Swedish and it's called Sister och Bror. But I keep the English translation in for the other languages. So it's kids, parents can go, they can read the story to them and also they can follow the English translation. So it's double-sided. And it's been so well received already. Mm. Well, God bless the parents. And I'm so happy that I did this small project. It was...
What made you go into the children's authorship? What was that? Why?
I just had an idea.
I know that you...
Like, again, it comes back to that thing. Like, I am amazing. I could do anything. Honestly, I have a thing where I believed I must be, I'll explain this to you in a very simple way because I it sounds bizarre and it's not how we see society, but you know the word hero?
Yeah.
The word hero comes from a Latin word, which means servo, which means servant, which means slave. And your hero is the person who serves you the most. So think about Superman or Wonder Woman or whatever, when they come down and catch you, they're your hero because they served you when you really most needed them. But for me, being a leader is always about being a service. It's about being a servant. Mm-hmm. And therefore, for me to be the hero of that family who can get their kid dealing with stress or depression or whatever and get them into meditation in a sort of sneaky way, I feel as if I could sit down and watch football tonight or I could watch Netflix, but I'm tired as well, don't get me wrong. I'm working hard all day, as you know. But I think there's some level inside me that thinks I can do it, so I should do it. And actually, the fact you asked, I'll actually tell you the full story. So I was working so hard last year, as you know, Jill. I was really pushing for this hard. And I didn't take any holidays. So coming up from September, they told me, you have to take your holidays. Mm-hmm. Typical Swedish thing. So I went to Mykonos, I went to Turkey, but I had days where I just was like, could I go away or not? And when I was in, I was actually, there's a place in Greece called Marathon. And I was going from the town of Marathon to Athens, which is the route where the original marathon went. And I had a friend whose son was suffering from a lot of anxiety. And he's a grown up sort of lad, he's a big lad. And I remembered, this was sort of in my mind for a couple of years, that one of my friends who was suffering from burnout, she was diagnosed with a coloring book, but it was a very simple coloring book, you know, to sort of get back into the moment, like the meditation of being in the moment with the coloring. So that week that I was in Marathon, I decided I'm going to do a coloring book for adults and like mature teens, you know, using stuff where you can really get a couple of days out of one thing just by filling it in and things like that. I just make sure that I'm not screwing up. But so I decided I would do it the week that I was off. And then I realized when I had done the first one that I could actually, most of the work was in the first book because I commissioned the drawings from an artist. Mm-hmm. And I realized then I could do 7 books in 7 days. So I did 7 coloring books in November in 7 days for, and they're all for adults and like mature teens. And I did one for, number one, for men, for women, for LGBTQ community, for boys, girls, people in lockdown, and for something else, highly spiritual people. Mm-hmm. And they were all sort of mostly the same type of format, same cover, but each color was the 7 colors of the rainbow on the covers when you see them all lined up. And I really did them because there's so much stress. There's so much anxiety, depression. And in the book, it's about mindful coloring. And if there's something I can recommend to some, I tried to keep them at around a fiver. That was my goal because the money goes to the homeless anyway, but I want people to buy them. That's the most important thing. So if there was something I would say to people, everyone at the moment is frazzled. People are so frazzled right now. So if you go to Amazon, search for Patrick Hamilton Walsh, buy that book and just treat yourself to some nice coloring in and just chill because you really deserve that me time. Mm. And that's why I did it because, you know, God bless. I really have empathy for people at the moment.
And I mean, we're not only dealing with this kind of like culture of busy, culture of, you know, productivity, culture of always having to be the best at things. We're also in the midst of, you know, a pandemic. And it kind of, I feel that kind of juxtapositioning of I have to be productive, I have to be all the time on top of something, doing something, creating something, you know, or else what's my worth, what's my value? But at the same time going, well, hang on a minute, we're all in the middle of a pandemic. It's a bit, can we really be as productive as we, maybe we should be resting. Maybe we should be more mindful of, you know, our mental health and taking care of ourselves. So I think, yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant concept. Yeah. Coloring is a brilliant concept. Definitely. So moving on to, you've arrived in Sweden with your wife. So you're a Kärlex invandrare, which, you know, both Kat and I are too. And how did, you know, what was your first reactions to being in Sweden? What was your first take?
I literally, so I have a rule. This is how I end up here. Because I have me and my wife were still traveling a while. And I had just released the first book. Yeah. And I did the publicity and stuff for that. Sorry, it was the Life Is book, my second book. And we came over here for Christmas time. And I have a rule as a backpacker that no matter where I get invited to, I will always say yes. You know, people's homes in Russia and, you know, wherever, I'll always say. So these guys reached out and they says, we've been following you on social media for quite a while and we'd love to meet you. And if you're going to be in Stockholm, we'd love to meet you in Mulgallerian for fika. And I thought, we'll be in Stockholm Thursday or something. And I met them. And they gave me an offer to move to Stockholm and help them build this company with Microsoft, a team called Picket, based out of Visby. And I was going to be, they're opening up this new building in Stockholm called Epicenter. And I was going to be the first member of Epicenter, get microchipped and all. I was thinking, how long have I been gone?
Oh my God, microchipped the minute you landed in Stockholm.
Wow, went on home. And so that I do you know what my very first thought was? I remember coming through the Tonobana under T Centrala, and I remember thinking, wow, this is a step up. Like I wasn't, don't forget, I was, there's no trains in Northern Ireland for Catholics. All the trains, they only run through Protestant towns, which is so bizarre. So I had never been on a train until I was, I think I was 15 or 16 before I was on a train ever. And I was in a Tunnelbana, you know, I think when I was 19 for the first time, like in Berlin. And so I was coming from, again, I'm such a farmer when I talk like today, but anyway, I remember thinking, this is a step up. This is a society which is at a different level from what I called home before.
What led you to become, I'm trying to get towards you becoming, you know, working for Stockholm City. That's what I'm leading to. Because that's a huge role to take on.
You need to start believing and going, you know what? I'm the perfect person for that job. I can take on any role. And all you can do is give it your best.
I think it's because I have that conversation in my head, which, you know, so many people do, of why would they pick me? Because there's going to be somebody who is from this country who is just as equally as skilled as I am to step into that role. So they're going to choose that person before they're going to choose me.
But no, you should never think like that. What I think is I'm the perfect person for this, and I can only give it what I have. I genuinely think there's better people than me out there, but also they probably don't believe in themselves either. Whereas I think I can, if I do my best in this and I'm honest and I have a service-minded approach to it and I'm kind, if I'm kind to people, I can do a good job here, because I'm not, as you can see, I'm not a humble person and I'm not really a nice person, because I think there's so much fake humility and fake niceness around. It doesn't stack up for me. Whereas kindness is kindness is kindness. You can feel and sense and grasp kindness, and when people,
it's got an integrity to it that
there's people better than me at everything, but I don't compare myself to them. I just know that I'm going to do my best in it, and I'm going to shine my brightest, and if that's not enough, then that's okay too. I mean, there'll be something then I will be good at, or I will be enough at it, but I'm not going to talk myself down for Sven or for Jonas or for Alan. They're awful people. But I'm not going to feel secondary to anyone, because I am enough.
And I think that's a good segue for us to start talking about this issue, which we've got. It's not an issue, but you know, so I have that already listening in me about being not good enough to go into that job because I'm not from this country. And I think there's a lot of people who are listening to this right now who also have that, you know, whether it's subconscious or whether it's, you know, it's just there's a little voice at the back of their head who's going, why would I? I'm not going to apply for that, or I don't have the right connections to get into that, you know, try that job out, or they're just going to turn around and tell me I don't have the right qualifications anyway. So why should it? So how do we go about you know, trying to break down those conversations in people's heads. How can we do that?
I can give you some. So it's, I actually list this in, I include this as part of the story, and forgive me, sister. And it was designed to brainwash women who read into knowing that they are enough. Actually, it was put into the story specifically for that reason. And it's one of the girls, and it's the two main characters in quite a weird situation, and they're repeating it to each other. And I'm going to do it with Hughes now. And the reason why is because storytelling is so important, okay? And the most important story is the story that we tell ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, this is where my second book was called Life Is, because I believe that what you put after that is what you have. So life is awesome, then you're having an awesome life. Life is crappy, your life's going not so good. But life is a full stop as well. Like, because to be in this life in this minute means that life is right here. Mm-hmm. So that was the main sort of big color book version of life is. And that book was designed for me to the story that I told you earlier, that's the introduction to the book. And in the book, I then go on more and talk about, you know, aspirationally, how I went on to achieve these other dreams, like becoming CEOs and, you know, doing these various things like breaking Guinness World Records and stuff like silly stuff. But it also is character building for us. And I think we need to have wins as individuals. And because people are rooting for us. Mm-hmm. People are close to us usually aren't vocal about it, and they and some of the people closest to us actually want us to fail as well, and that's difficult mm-hmm. to deal with, to know that people so close to you really genuinely
yeah.
want you to lose, whereas some strangers online are really rooting for you, and, yeah. and that's this is mm-hmm. the truth, and this and it comes back to this: we must believe in ourselves, because we are an island on this floating. Through the universe, and therefore I work so hard to maintain my what works in my heart. And I told you earlier, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't gamble, I don't have any of the vices. And the reason why is because it takes me off away from my happiness. And I did all that when I was in my 20s and 30s and all that, you know. But as I get older now, I have to fast. I have to. And the reason why I'm being disciplined with myself is because I need to take care of this one and this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really always trying to go, right, okay, that doesn't serve me anymore. That was awesome then, but it doesn't mm-hmm. serve me anymore. And therefore, I think we have to accumulate stuff in here and in here, but we have to eliminate stuff which impacts us having that. Because mm-hmm. I stopped drinking. The last time I ever drank was maybe 4 or 5 years ago as well. And it was literally, I couldn't justify going out for a couple of pints and then hung over for 2 days. It's a real bad thing for me to, the thing is, it's not just being hungover and then eating crappy foods. I'm not exercising. I'm not having good conversations. I'm not.
It's like a spiral. It's a spiral. It's yeah.
And more so, every year I start, and this is in the Life Is book and in the Backpacker book. I talk about how I start or stop something every year for 1 year. So 1 year I went off drinking for a year and I kept off it. 1 year I went off sugar for a year but couldn't keep off it, but I did my best. 1 year I started yoga for a year and I kept going. So starting something or stopping something, and it's called the 366-day challenge, where, and it's just my own thing. I started on my birthday and I stop it the day after my birthday the next year. Just so mm-hmm. hopefully it'll carry through, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very disciplined in the fact that I, from a selfish perspective, I want to be happy. And I think the more happy I am with me, then the more that I can help others. Because if my cup is empty, then I can't share with anyone. You know, I don't have that energy or that, you know, that positivity to give.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we confuse happiness with comfort.
Mm.
And I know I do. So, you know, the sort of quick fix comfort that you might get from a glass of wine or a chocolate biscuit or, I don't know, whatever it is that your vice is, you know, you sort of think, oh, quick fix comfort. Mm, yeah. But in the long run, how does it actually accumulate and how does it impact your life? You know, as it goes on. Now, we don't have very much time because I know that you've got to dash off, but I really do want to very quickly talk about the report that you were commissioned to write by Stockholm City about talent retention. Because I think that's international talent retention, I should say, be more specific. And that's how you and I met, because I think somebody introduced us and recommended that you interview me as part of the report about particularly focusing on spousal care and, you know, international spouses coming here with partners who are working, and how do we take care of these people? How can we do better to take care of these people? And recently, I think a few days ago, another report was released by, I think it was the MUFC, which is, I can't remember. No. Sounds like them, but it wasn't. MUCF, I should say. I'm sorry. So that stands for, let me just bring it up right now. The Myndigheten för ungdom och civilsamhällsfrågor.
Wow.
So that was the, and they produced a report about international, about foreign-born women, particularly young women between the ages of 20 and 29, and their attempts to get onto the Swedish labour market.
It that I seen actually I didn't read into the report. I actually seen an article about it, and it
Yes.
broke my heart.
Aha. Yeah.
It really annoys me. Again, it's so difficult to be a woman. Okay, so what do these girls do? They leave their home country, go to a place where they think, okay, Sweden's a woman's place. Let's go there, and we'll have a better opportunity. They come here, and then they're even more excluded. And it's a, and I actually tweeted this out during the week. I said, this is a major source of major frustration for me. Because it's like the worst case scenario. It really frustrates me, I have to be honest. The almost it's nothing to, I don't blame the Swedes for it because it's their culture is they're very they have very small and deep circles of friends. And if I'm a guy coming to Sweden, it's a lot more easier for me to break into these circles because men don't really feel so threatened by other men. But when I talk to even Swedish girls who've moved to Stockholm, they have literally zero friends. They have zero friends, and it's so difficult for other groups of women to that and a newcomer into the group. And I think it's some sort of threat or whatever that is, or she might take, or I don't know what it is, but this is the reality. And you know that the I'll give you two facts. The most Googled "How do I" in Ireland is "How do I travel through time?" Okay. Most Googled "How do I" in Sweden is "How do I make one friend?"
Seriously. Wow.
And it's for me, it's such a thing that I wish that my role in the city had come at a different time because I wanted to make it into more of a networking thing, and that's why I loved what you were doing, Jill. Because I love people coming together and putting one person's hand into another and say, shake hands, this will be awesome. And to work together on some level, or you should at least be friends. Because loneliness is the equivalent of smoking something like two boxes of cigarettes a day or something. That's the impact it has on your health. And I think about a few of the guys I interviewed, like single guys from Pakistan coming here. They're just not going to get any friends. They're never going to meet Swedish people outside of their job. And even in work, they're not going to be invited for fika or anything like that. They'll be there, but it's so Sweden is very much focused on non-discrimination. Okay. But I really would prefer if people focused on integration. I mean, just having a couple of girls in the office or a couple of guys from different religions or different countries isn't, it doesn't matter because the average time that people stay is 22 months, which means they're coming, they're getting 1.5 years on their CV because now it's tick the box. And they're looking for an exit because they just weren't integrated into the society. And I think I was talking to one of the leaders of Microsoft 2 weeks ago. And he says, whenever the head of Europe for Microsoft came to Sweden, she says, that they were going on about the gender splits. What's that called? What's the word?
Gender gap or
Yeah, like
gender, gender
equality, like gender equality. He says equality is not about, it's not across genders. It's across everything. You're so focused on having so many girls in this position, but they're all Swedish girls. Where's Jill? Where's Kat? No, where's the girl from Pakistan? You know, they're girls too. If you're going to just look at girls, where's the lads from Pakistan? Where's the transgender from South America whose family are religious Catholics and they had to, you know.
Fleeing persecution,
Know what I mean? These stories exist, and it's a that report this week. It hurt. It hit me hard because I.
And I think, you know, I think like from I wasn't surprised by the report
Oh.
at all because and a lot of the people that I spoke to and shared it with were the same. We weren't surprised because I've been hearing that same story for the last 6 years through all the work that I've done through Little Bear Abroad, through all the people that I've met through the different networks that I've worked in and so on and so forth. Every story has been the same for women trying to get a job. You know, it takes it takes a huge uphill struggle for somebody to finally get a job. And once they do finally get something, it's usually an internship, or it's an unpaid position somewhere, or it's, you know, and I know it's more to do with, you know, this idea, it's more to do with connections and networking than it is to do with, say, for example, blatant, it's not racism, it's about networking and connections, people knowing who you are, people understanding your level of qualifications, your experience, et cetera. So it's, yeah, it wasn't a surprise to me, but I just hope that it's shone a bit of a light on the situation.
I
I
don't
think
think
the really disappointing thing was that the report concluded that networking was the most important thing and said it didn't know how that could be resolved for foreign-born women in Sweden because they are completely excluded from these networks, and that that would be the one way that they could improve the situation. But how to get to that point where foreign-born women were included in these networks that they needed to be in to be able to get
Because there
employment.
are, I mean, there are lots of foreign-born women professional networks in Sweden, but it's like they've been kind of, you know, ghettoized into this other little corner over here, whereas they're not being included in this sort of wider. And I know, I mean, it is, of course, it's a language thing. It is a
I
language.
don't think it is, because a lot of the lads I know don't. Obviously, they don't have the language either. It's this is I was so much focused on Spoilsker as part of my time in Invest.com, and it was about this. It was trying to get women to be more caring and sharing with each other, and to try and solve this for themselves, and to let you guys know that you can solve this for yourself, because there is no cavalry. No one's coming to help you, and Patrick is not even going to fix it himself. But if he can even stand on stage and go, right, this is a vision that I have for women helping women in, you know, outside of the traditional boundaries. And I'm not mad at the Swedish people or nothing, because at the end of the day,
No.
people like themselves, and these
Of course,
people
it's
have
the
got.
same everywhere.
I mean, it's just, I mean, I always say the same. Like, I don't stand at Dublin Airport with a sign saying "free hugs" for no, and I shouldn't expect the Swedes to do it for me. You know,
Absolutely not.
and that's the thing. Like, it's human nature to take care of your tribe and to reach out and to try to elevate. Like I have really wanted to come on here to support this podcast, because yous are my tribe. Like, the fact that I'm the first boy to come on and to even reach out and go, like, let me support yous. We must do that. We must support our girls. And I feel your pain. I really am, and I'm doing
But
what I could.
what do you think the future is then? What do you think the, I mean, in you, I think I thought there was some in the report that was written last year, that you wrote, there were some really innovative suggestions for future, you know, future solutions. But of course the pandemic happened. And that caused, you know, some, you know, it curtailed some of the potential solutions that we could have. You know, not you can't really meet people as freely or network as much as you can, and so on. So how can you know, what do you think the future is for foreign-born women to network, to integrate themselves into these, into these, into this, into the labor market? Sorry to put you on the spot.
Women have to appreciate that your network is your net worth. Okay? And you have to do it as individuals. And it again, it's a strange one with being a woman, because at one level you have to put yourself out there and connect, and, you know, talk to the guy or the girl at the coffee machine without being, you know, without being given reference to do that. And at the same time, you have to be careful, because you're a woman and people can read it wrong. So most of the people, most of the connections I have is that I walked up to get a cup of tea, and as it was filling my cup, I just started talking to the person beside me. And of course, some people will go, well, who's this weird guy talking to me? He's fancying me, or he's this, or he's that. And I'm like, no, I'm literally just getting a cup of tea, and I'm entertaining myself at the same time. You know, for the fact that I'm going to have 10 seconds, how are you? Or I like your hair, or I like your shoes. And I say that to men and women every day. And I'll give you an example. I was in Epicenter a few weeks ago, and there was a new guy who started on the team, and I said, welcome to the team, bro. great to have you here. He's a non-Swedish guy in his heritage. And he goes, yeah, good to see you again too. And I was, where have we met? And he, you met me in El Giganten. You got your laptop fixed a few years ago. And when I hear that, it makes me so happy and proud, because I have a rule that every person who serves me in Max, in IKEA, wherever, I always leave them a compliment. And it has to be genuine, because people can feel when you're talking nonsense. So if I met you today, Jill, I would compliment either your hair or your glasses, because they both look good on you. For you as well, I would like compliment your hair. You know, and or else if you did a good job and you didn't screw up my order, I would be like, here, well done, I appreciate it. You know, just telling people you did a good job, thank you so much. They remember you. And this has happened to me a few times. So I met a different young lad one time, and I said, man, I like your hair. And he goes to me, I know you told me last time. And I was, probably did.
Oh, damn it. So are you saying then that we should just ignore that cultural rule that, you know, we have in Sweden, where if a stranger talks to you, they just think that you're crazy?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the reason why I have the network I do is because let the people who don't matter think I'm crazy. If that's what it is, then if you think I'm crazy, I don't want to hang out with you. I don't want to be associated with you. But the cool people actually do want to chat, and they actually will remember you, and they will. So, no, I think be honest to yourself and be a bit greedy. Like, know that every person you talk to is potentially a future friend. And remember, this is another thing I was trying to say to girls as well, and to young lads. The worst way to build a connection with someone is to try to build a connection with them.
Yeah.
Just be yourself. And I mean, you can always find a compliment in someone, and you can say, like, I really, and people don't, the other thing is people feel intention. If I tell you, and I probably told you, I probably complimented you that day we met first time, and you felt my intention was pure. Like, I was just saying to you, Jill, I like your jacket, or I like whatever, your shoes, or I like your vibe. You didn't think I was being sleazy, because you felt my intention was just compliment you. It wasn't to come on to you or be weird.
Yeah, the last thing I felt was, that it was a sleazy, absolutely.
You know what I mean? And that's what intention always comes across. People, a lot of people don't realize this. Intention is pure, and it's very resonant as well.
I think that's why I find it so difficult when you're actually forced into that situation of, like, networking events, you know, where you go to a networking event and that's the sole purpose. And, you know, I kind of almost have the opposite reaction. I sort of go, I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to, you know, because there's people there going, oh, hi, what, you know, who are you? What do you do? What do you work with? And I'm like, I know all you want to know is whether I work for some really big, you know,
what can you get from
IT company? Exactly. Yeah. You know, instead of that thing of being genuinely interested in the person that's standing in front of you without knowing any of their attributes or connections, you know, their connections. So it's I think that's a very good piece of advice.
Yeah, definitely. The best way to build a network is not to try to build a network. Just see the people as human beings. And I have the best connections I've ever met was just people that I met at the. I'll give you one example. This was a great one, right? I started a new job for a NASDAQ company. And they were based in Ireland, and they wanted someone to head up their Swedish office. So my first week, Amadalens was on. And we were writing this outdoor thing, and I had a tea and like a vegan hot dog or something, and I was looking to sit down. So I could have sat on my own, but I seen these two older men sitting in, you know, 20 meters from me, and I thought, screw it, I'm going to talk to these lads. And I went over and I was chatting with them and blah, blah, blah. And I was telling them, what are you doing here? I'm working for this construction tech company and blah, blah, blah. And as I was leaving, your boy goes, by the way, I'm probably the guy you were looking to meet. And he gave me his card, and it was Gunnar Hangman, who was the CEO of Skanska, the biggest construction company. And
did you not even know who he was?
I didn't care. I just wanted to chat. And I was walking away, and I didn't ask them what they did or anything. But, and people appreciate that. Like, they didn't think, they felt again that I wasn't coming over to. Like, I didn't have a sneaky thing written down. I'm going to go over and annoy him. They would sense it so far away.
Yeah.
And, I got that company straight into the, they were doing this sort of project with all these different startups, and I got it straight in, and they were only allowing like 20 companies in. And yeah, there were people pitching to them every day. I just went straight on at the top for this company.
And yeah, it just goes to prove it's who you know, it's not what you know. That's absolutely the one. Kat, is there anything else that you would like to ask Patrick?
Not really ask. I just would like to say thank you to Patrick, because I feel like this has been like, oh, just you've given both Jill and I sort of this personal confidence boost today. I wrote down, I've only written down one thing while we've been talking, and I've written down in big letters, self-belief. And that just is like, thank you, because it's that's what I feel has come out of this conversation, is the importance of self-belief. I think mm-hmm. You've put that really strongly.
Especially in the face of adversity or personal adversity, you know, like when you don't think that you can, you just keep going.
And just remember this, like it's even if you're not having a self-belief day, just realize I am enough. Like I'll work it out. There's enough in me. I've come this far. I've moved country. I've done whatever. Like I'm enough. I can get through it. Just give me a chance. And there's another thing too. Like I'm an Irish Catholic, so I always say, God, I don't ask for you to, you know, make my life easier. I ask you for you to make me stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, just give me the strength to overcome whatever is thrown at me, mm-hmm. as opposed to hoping that it's going to be easier, because the easy things are the small things really. And I want to do the big things. I want to be, you think that job title I had was big. That's awesome. But for me, I didn't think it was big. I just thought, make me strong. And that's all I'm going to say there. Just like, believe, man, just know that you're enough.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I think that's the soundbite for this episode. Patrick, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and couldn't have asked for more. It's been terrific.
Yep. Thank you very much for giving some of your valuable time to come on the podcast and talk to us.
I'm so honored.
Maybe one day you'll come back and do another self-belief session with Kat and I.
We'll do a few more, and at the end of the summer, start of the winter next year, whatever, I would love to come back and give you, because there's so much stuff I've just left out today. But I would, if your listeners like it, I will come back and give them a top up, and
definitely.
No problem with that. And I'll have you guys on my own podcast as well.
Yeah,
and let you share your story.
Let's do a crossover podcast crossover.
I on my podcast is boy girl boy girl boy girl, and it's so hard to find women to come on a podcast. You know, they just don't, a lot of my really strong friends don't believe that they can talk for an hour about who they are. And I'm like, come on, we talk for.
I have no problem with that.
No problem.
Okay, well, thank you again, and we'll see you soon. Mm.